That cough at a recent dance performance by a local choreographer was not from the audience. It was from a dancer, and it was intentional. A woman in a red dress and a man in black jeans moved across the floor, sometimes looking perfectly serene, but often in visible agony. At one point, the man even crawled across the floor on his knuckles. It hurt just to watch it. This dance performance wasn't about swans or fairy tale characters in love. It was all about the sensation of pain, and that is the topic of today's Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Gina Kaufman, and the choreographer of that piece is with me in the studio. Good morning, dancer Jane Gotch. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
So, pain, huh?
I'm so touched by that recording. It almost brought me to tears.
I can see that, but yeah, just it's this journey you've been through.
Yes.
What gave you the idea of exploring pain through dance?
Well, when I first met Julia and Leo, we had coffee, each of us separately, and both of them had experienced a pretty extreme and deep loss in their personal lives and said to me that they really needed this project in order to help them make it through. It was not my intended direction for the piece, but it seemed such a pertinent and of the moment topic for both of them that I thought it might permeate the work no matter what my intention.
So you started with emotional pain.
Well, so we had a rehearsal in the beginning where we worked with a form called authentic movement, which is an improvisation form where you're moving from an internal sensation and listening rather than an external aesthetic or form. And in one of these rounds of improvisation, Julia and I were dancing together. We are both trained in a similar Western classical form. At the end of that period of time or improvisation, Leo said to us, "You guys look like you are in pain." And it was kind of startling because that's not a typical way we would speak about our movement.
Yeah, dancers often, in fact, if there is something uncomfortable, will go out of their way to mask that for the audience.
To beautify it. Yes, exactly. But as I thought about it, I really, so much, historically, so much modern and contemporary dance has dealt with pain. I also said to Leo that his training and movement as a breakdancer also looks like pain, the popping and locking and controlled and intense muscular contraction. So this began a discussion rehearsal about how does pain look? How do we look whilst in pain? Does pain look different in Leo and Juliet? Does pain look different in different ethnicities? How does pain look different on a stage as opposed to when we're really going through it in real life?
What are some of the answers that you personally have come to through this? I mean, we'll start with this, maybe an easy one, like you were working with two dancers. Did pain look different from one dancer to another?
It did, but there was also a deeper human aspect that was the same. And that's a theme I feel, a life theme of mine as well as an art theme, is looking for the similarities in us. I began to want to explore vulnerability as well. That seems like goes hand in hand with pain. And how that looks in Leo, who's an extremely strong, physical, tall man. How does that look in Juliet? Trying to, break down some of the stereotypes that we have, especially even just in dance stereotypes of vulnerability or beauty in a woman versus a man.
That's interesting. I have a little bit of a background in dance. It's in the distant past now, but there was a dance teacher I had who talked a lot about that when we try to show strength, that we're also showing vulnerability, that there's this misperception that if you would be like hunched over or something, that that would be vulnerability, or that that would be, but that actually the strongest positions are the most exposed and most vulnerable. Like if your neck is exposed, that's incredibly vulnerable, but it's only like a strong creature that feels comfortable being in that position.
That's exactly right. Upright, and to an audience, upright, fully exposed, very little theatrical expression, I think, is a very, to stand still in front of an audience is a very vulnerable place to be.
A lot of the time, so much of what dancers are trying to express with their bodies is not physical. They're using their bodies to communicate an emotion or idea or to become a character in a story. There's something so logical and direct about exploring pain through dance. Was it almost so logical that it was intimidating in a way?
You know, it kind of, not really intimidating. It just seemed like, duh. Like, why haven't we ever talked about this? Actually, I was very curious about it in just self-reflection of how I've spent my life.
Because dancing does just involve pain also.
It does. Innately, like you're going to have, I mean, my first injury happened when I was 12 years old.
What was it?
I fractured L5 in my spine. It had healed back together, but I had pretty
severe. That's a vertebra?
Vertebra, mm-hmm.
Ow. You had a spinal injury at 12?
Yes.
Wow. Do you still have symptoms from that injury?
It comes and goes. That's actually what led me into studying and now teaching gyrotonic and gyrokinesis, was as a sustainable way to teach myself new ways of movement and new patterns of movement that were going to help me stay balanced through the longevity of my career.
Explain gyrotonic and gyrokinesis.
Well, it's a system of movement therapy and exercise that was developed by Julio Horvath. He was a professional dancer, a yogi, and martial artist who moved to the U.S. in the early 70s. He herniated 3 discs in his low back and ruptured his Achilles tendon and developed the system of movement while living in St. Thomas for 7 years to heal his own back, his own injuries. And then he came from a family of woodworkers, so he developed a group of 5 pieces of equipment around that are structured around the human body and the way it moves. It first was a movement therapy called yoga for dancers, for professional dancers in New York, but now it's used in all types and forms of rehab.
Well, so now that you're exploring pain through dance, and not just in that case, not just managing pain or working with pain as an individual, but trying to express something about it, were there challenges that surprised you just in capturing the experience of pain through a few particular bodies on a stage without words?
Well, it always is like this in work, that is trying to penetrate something that you've never done before, or that is emotional, tenuous, is personal things come up. Like you can't separate it. There was this process, this piece took 2 years of process, and there was definitely deep personal connections that came up between myself and the dancers and the dancers themselves. I had never worked on a piece for this long, and that was very surprising about how deep we became connected to each other.
So you spent 2 years kind of walking around with thoughts about pain percolating. did you come to great realizations? Most of us, unless forced, have not done that.
You know, it's my work is always in a way preceding what I then deal with in my own life. It's teaching me something that I haven't even been aware that I need to learn. So I feel like, yes, now I'm on a different path in looking at my own pain and where I want to go with choreography and work.
We communicate just as people that we are in pain, both intentionally and unintentionally. I mean, if your leg hurts, maybe you wince and gasp when you put your weight on it, and that would be sort of a pretty dramatic way of showing that. But even if you don't do that, there's maybe a subtle favoring of one leg over the other that gives you away. Are those different personality expressions of pain, and is that something you were working with as well?
We didn't deal that much with, like you said, a physical pain. I think that that does play out in emotional planes as well. Yes, I watched these two people for years, and I began to see how they dealt with their own personal circumstances and not use them, but let them be themselves in the piece.
When you work with dancers or in your gyrotonic and gyrokinesis training with clients, is it interesting for you as someone who has experienced your own fair share of pain to interact with other people around their pain and to see those differences just across the spectrum and to try and work with those differences?
Oh, it's a learning curve for me. I have to learn each person's pain tolerance and scale of what is painful is completely different. How they identify with their pain. Sometimes I have my clients give it a color, give it a feeling, name it so that it becomes something tangible. That takes me months to really understand a person. And I feel like it's my job to adapt to them.
Have you identified like different types as far as just dealing, let's strictly with the physical pain, but dealing with it mentally?
There are kind of two very gross segregations. I would say there's people that want to submerge it and there's people that want to express it. And most of us, maybe even at different times in our lives, fall into different those two different categories.
How we deal with pain, I mean, it's different from person to person, but have you ever personally had a turning point with a physical sensation where it started as one thing and then you made an adjustment, either a physical adjustment or a thought adjustment that changed everything?
Pretty much every day. Every time I go into my practice of movement, I am assessing where is my body today? What does it feel like today? How can I change my perspective from a microcosmic sensation of this thing that's hurting to macrocosmic? I know enough to know that pain in the body is also often formed or is a cause of something that's happening somewhere else. So by changing my perspective, I often can rectify or lessen that pain and have a better experience of moving.
I remember being a really little kid and having the realization that if I was really, really cold during recess or whatever, my muscles would tense up just as a kind of seemingly an automatic response. But if I deliberately relaxed my muscles and didn't allow myself to have that response, the cold became more bearable. Is that a kind of process, finding those little things that you, is that a process you go through as a choreographer?
As a choreographer.
Or as a dancer.
Definitely as a moving human being. You know, working with our mind is such a game, and it's actually quite usable and workable to approach your mind as a child and play with it. I like to play with all kinds of things in rehearsal, and I really don't care if it's quote unquote working or not. That process of playing and reorganizing and looking at it this way, I'll move around the room, see it from a different angle. Does it have a different meaning? Yes.
It seems that classical dance has a really particular kind of attitude toward pain, and that just becoming proficient in dancing like on point shoes requires that you endure enough pain that your feet stop blistering and start callusing. Pain is so normal in classical dance that your ability to push through it is almost a badge of honor, your body has to kind of give out before you've earned permission to stop and heal. Are modern and contemporary dance that way too?
Yes, I think not to the same extreme, but that would greatly be determined by the style of modern dance, the company you're working with, if you're under a professional contract or not to complete this performance. Yes.
Choreographer and dancer Jane Gotch, stay with me through the break, okay?
Thanks, sure.
I'm KCUR's Gina Kaufman, and Central Standard will be right back, this time with a pain doctor and a philosopher. Because different schools of thought see pain differently. That's coming up. Don't go away.
If I still feel, I focus on the pain, the only thing.
Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today, we're talking about pain, not just as a symptom that requires treatment, though it's that, but also a larger force in our lives. Jane Gotch is a dancer and choreographer here in town who's created a dance piece exploring how we carry and express emotional discomfort. Hi again, Jane.
Hi.
Let's bring some additional perspectives in on this conversation. Dr. Lynn Webster is at the forefront of pain medicine. He's the vice president of scientific affairs at PRA Health Sciences. He's also the immediate past president of the American Academy of Pain Medicine. He's written more than 300 scientific abstracts, as well as a book, and these writings form the basis for other physicians who treat and study pain. Dr. Lynn Webster, welcome to KCUR's Central Standard.
Hello, thank you for having me.
You're in town for a talk this Friday at the Center for Practical Bioethics, all about the moral obligation to treat pain. Explain that.
Well, actually, the talk is this evening, it's about the issue of chronic pain. You know, 100 million Americans experience chronic pain, and unfortunately, it's stigmatized, and oftentimes we're not recognizing the people with the problem, and we offer very little options to many people with chronic pain.
Well, what sparked your interest in pain as an area of real specialization?
Oh, well, that's a long story. You don't have enough show here. but I'll tell you, the short story is that back in the late 80s and early 90s, I began to see that there was a huge need, and I was able to provide a benefit to a large population of patients I was treating. And I saw that as a new frontier, and there was probably no other area in medicine where I thought I could make a larger contribution than in the field of pain medicine.
So do you have the sense that doctors and patients see pain differently?
Oh, patients, people? Everybody sees pain differently, and there are almost a limitless number of different perceptions and attitudes. And in fact, that is one of our greatest challenges, is to try to bring together a change in the attitudes towards both the people who are experiencing pain, but also pain itself. I mean, historically, pain has been viewed as a symptom, and it is a symptom early on, but it frequently and too commonly becomes a disease in and of itself. And that's our struggle today.
How would you identify that difference, when the moment when pain has become its own condition?
Well, it becomes chronic by a definition of more than 3 months. But when it becomes a disease is when it's actually contributing to the destruction of somebody. We call that a maladaptive process. So when it begins to cause harm in many different ways, as opposed to a symptom that is a warning sign that you should back away, allow the tissues to heal, allow whatever it is that's been harmed to recover. But at some point, that the body then takes over and actually feeds into the disease and becomes self-destructive.
Explain that more, because I'm not totally there with you yet.
Okay, well, there are a number of different ways to look at this, and frankly, let's first take a look at pain and the analogy of cancer. When we think of the word pain, we think of just an injury that produces one sensation, but it's not true. Just like cancer, there are multiple different cancers. There are multiple different sources of pain. There are different types of pain. There are different types of cancer. And the sites where cancer causes harm, or the tissues that cause harm, or the mechanism, the receptors, are as different as pain has on different sites of injury and where that process occurs. So the spine and the brain receives information from injured tissue. And at some point, it actually begins almost immediately, but at some point, that spine and brain changes in form and function so that it actually then becomes a different basic organism, and it begins to feed itself. It's like inflammation in the brain and the spinal cord. So we call that sensitization, central sensitization or peripheral sensitization. These are like inflammation. If you have an infection, you see the tissue is inflamed. The same can happen within the nervous system, and it occurs with chronic pain stimulus to the brain and to the spine.
Whoa. Okay. Well, I think something within the medical field that most people have interacted with on some level is what I would consider sort of a bizarre trend in recent years toward asking people to rate their pain on a scale of 1 to 10. It feels like such a bureaucratic way of evaluating something that is incredibly primal. Can you talk about medical ideas about evaluating pain?
Yeah, you know, that's actually an insightful comment. You know, it is not meant to be to try to quantitate the pain as much as it is to bring attention to it as an element that we should be assessing. So it's a part of the body. It's a way to try to bring attention to a problem that the body's experiencing, more than it is to try to place it on some scale of 0 to 10. Because frankly, people who have severe pain, and we would categorize that with people on that scale of 7 to 10, rarely move off of that, even with aggressive treatment, but their function and quality of life can be dramatically improved. Because we can't often cure chronic pain, particularly the severe chronic pain, but we can heal. And that's the big difference between the way we have historically tried to approach the pain problem and where we need to be today.
So how do you, in this evaluating pain thing, how do you deal with this issue of different people feeling differently about expressing pain or talking about pain? I mean, someone might be more inclined to downplay their pain. Another person might be more inclined to, I don't want to say exaggerate, but to really express their pain very openly.
So I would make this analogy. I mean, if we go into a movie and you ask the people who've left the movie what they thought about it, they're going to have many different impressions. Pain is the sum of all of our life's experiences. That's how we experience pain as individuals. And so it's similar to going into the movie and coming out, and you're asking somebody to give you a qualitative assessment of their experience of pain at that moment in time. Same occurs with somebody who's just left a movie. If you ask five people what they thought of that movie, they're going to have different impressions, just as we would have a different impression from the same pain stimulus of an individual who's been injured.
In the case of chronic pain, I know that this isn't the case, but so in the case of chronic pain, the pain is a problem in and of itself. But typically, outside of that circumstance, would you say that pain is how you identify something, some underlying cause that's going on? And how do you deal with this idea that you don't want people to be in pain, but you also don't want to shoot the messenger?
Well, pain is, as I say, it's really all of our affective, that is, our emotional, psychological, it's a biopsychosocial disorder and spiritual. So if somebody has the wherewithal, if they have the ability, the emotional personality to manage the pain stimulus well, they were going to have a different response than somebody who might catastrophize, somebody who has an anxiety disorder, somebody who has some other emotional issues. So how they express it, how they experience it, will be entirely different based upon their individual personalities and genetics.
Well, speaking of pain as a messenger, that was an idea espoused by the poet Rumi, who wrote, "The pains you feel are messengers. Listen to them." Philosophers have given a lot of thought to pain throughout the ages, so we thought we'd also include a philosopher in this discussion. Sarah Robbins, with us from KU. Thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks.
What are some of the different ways philosophers have characterized pain and our relationship to it?
Well, philosophers of mind in particular think about the connection between the mind and the body, so how those two things might be related. And pain, as the other two people that are with us today have made really evident in what they've had to say, pain is simultaneously something that seems to be very much about the body and also something that's entirely in one's head. So the puzzle of how to figure out the nature of pain and its relation to that connection is a very important one for philosophers.
Do you have any favorite sort of philosophical interpretations of pain, like some specific philosophers you could take us through?
I think I'd be more inclined to think through some of the sort of puzzles about pain that a lot of philosophers have had something to say about. One of which is, as has come up here, in the idea of rating your pain, the puzzle of how we don't actually know what someone else's pain is. So if I rated mine a 3 and someone else rated theirs a 5, we wouldn't have any way of actually pulling those out and comparing them. So it's very much about my own experience of that thing that no one else truly gets access to. But at the same time, so one of the things that comes along with that is that pain is only pain while you're experiencing that pain. So if you can be distracted from it or in some sense cease to feel it, cease to be aware of it, then you're no longer in pain.
That is interesting to me because I would say that one of the most incredible things about pain is the way it brings itself into sharp focus, like that, in fact, that you, everything else tends to disappear. So the idea of distracting yourself from pain, I can understand that as kind of a solution. But I also would think that philosophically, if I would think about what is a tool, like what is pain a tool for focus, actually, maybe not on what you want to focus on.
Absolutely. So it does take a lot of control through, you know, or something fortuitous to distract you away from the pain in order for it to go away. But so that gives you in some ways great control over it, but also it control over you. So as long as it's a part of your experience, then you're in pain. And if you can find a way to make that not a part of your experience, then you're no longer in pain.
Voltaire was a French author who, of course, he was a French author, but he had this character who was, you know, all is for the best in this best of all worlds. And that was a real, he was making fun of this character, but he was also making fun of a school of philosophy. Determinism, mm-hmm. I think, is what it was. And so, like, the nose is created so that glasses can sit on it. And this is an example of that everything is for the best in this best of all worlds. And so then a Brazilian author makes fun of Voltaire by creating a character who believes that all is for the best in this best of all worlds, where you can tighten your boots so tight that it hurts only to experience the freeing sensation of undoing that pain. Is there an actual school of philosophy like this?
I think there are several that could that would play up on those relationships. So some people would think, and it's, I think, a natural thought to have, that the sensation of pain is important for appreciating the pleasures that we do have, sometimes either bound up in that actual emotional state or previous experience of pain makes pleasant experiences more rewarding and interesting.
Are there any other, like, uses for pain in a human's search for meaning, or is it mostly a thing we try to avoid and that philosophers are trying to find tools for managing?
Yeah, so I mean, it can be helpful for remembering things. So some have thought that that's quite, that pain is very important for the forming and lasting impact of memory. And pain can be useful just as an organism for telling you when something is wrong with you. So it's certainly valuable for those reasons. And it's a morally significant sensation or emotion. And so for those
morally.
Reasons, I think so. So most of the time, we tend to think the things that should be avoided and prevented and addressed are the things that cause harm and the experience of the unpleasantness of pain. So that's it's a good guide towards the things that we find morally objectionable are those that cause pain.
Dancer Jane Gotch, are you hearing anything that speaks to your experience with pain in all of this?
Definitely. I was making some notes, actually. There is a aspect or a type of exercise we do in gyrotonic called nerve strengthening, where you have the student squeeze something with their hold a small weight in their hands and squeeze it so tight that there's almost a shivering sensation. And with special kinds of breathing patterns, working to, in a way, sort of push and pull the body through the stimulation, when you release it, there's a flood of release and relaxation that enters that part of the body and actually the whole system. So in what you were talking about, the tightening your boots in order to release and feel that pleasure of freeing yourself.
So if you are in a profession that's given you unusual insights into pain, feel free to give us a call and share your perspective. The number to call is 816-235-2888. Lynn Webster, is there a scientific or physiological explanation for any of the phenomena that our philosopher Sarah Robbins has just described? Either, you know, pain helping with memory or the sensation of relief?
Well, yes. I think to some degree, although we don't understand pain really well, we do know that pain can produce neuroendocrine changes, and certain neuroendocrine secretions will sensitize the memory area of our brain so that we will remember. And, you know, we're more likely to remember those noxious stimuli. We're also more likely to remember the euphoric experiences, and we tend to not want to repeat the noxious ones. So yes, there are neuroendocrine explanations for the memory that's imprinted in after a painful experience.
Is there a way scientifically that you would describe the relief you feel when pain that has been persistent is suddenly removed?
Well, I don't know. I would say that's euphoria. Let's look at the acute pain situation. And a lot of your listeners are probably women who have had babies, and they may have had an epidural during that process. I think that they'd probably tell you that it was pretty wonderful once that epidural set in place to relieve that pain. So from a physiologic perspective, if you're blocking the pain signal to the brain and to the spinal cord, that is a wonderful relief. You know, I was thinking as you were commenting about this with the boots, that always tended to be, for me, the most enjoyable part of skiing was when I took my boots off. So, you know, there you go.
Well, and yeah, when you're sick in any way, you'll have maybe just something so simple is suddenly obstructed, like your ability to breathe clearly. And then all it takes to make you incredibly joyous is just being able to breathe like a normal person when you feel better. But it takes about a day before you're back to griping about all the usual problems. Philosophically, is this a conundrum?
It is a conundrum, I think, in that we, for our ways of thinking about the ways that pleasure and pain are related. So they seem, often the release of pain is pleasurable, but pain and pleasure aren't perfectly symmetrical sensations. So as you're mentioning, the pleasure of being able to breathe normally or have your feet not be incredibly constricted goes away pretty quickly. Pleasure in seeking something out can come to pull apart over time, whereas pain and the desire to avoid it never seem to pull apart. And that's intriguing for philosophers.
And we've brought up this idea of pain being on some level in your head. Unfortunately, I think a lot of people have heard the phrase all in your head in kind of a disparaging way. But how much of the pain experience is in our heads? And I think more importantly, who gets to decide whether it's quote unquote real? I'll start with you, Sarah.
I think it's natural to think that in some sense that you are always the authority on your own pain. So, you know, a clinician can tell you that there's no physical tissue damage or nothing to indicate where your experience is coming from. But, you know, so long as you're not lying, I think if you say you're in pain, then then you're the authority on that.
Have you, you've noted some experiments along these lines, right?
Yes. Well, the experiments I think I mentioned before are more about what people will judge about other people's ideas about whether they can be in pain. But I think we all tend to agree that even though we locate it in the body, the absence of physical evidence can be trumped by your personal commitments about those things, what you say about whether you're in pain.
I'm intrigued by your choice of the word commitment. Are we committed to our pain?
I think we're committed. Well, I don't know if we're committed in what sense you would say that you're committed to it, but you are the authority on the statements about those parts of your mental experiences. So other things, if I say that I see a pink elephant in here, and there's, for the listeners, there's no pink elephant in here, I can be right that that's how it seems to me, but that's not actually, I don't get to be the authority on what's in the room.
Yeah, everyone else agreeing that there's no pink elephant trumps your statement.
Exactly, but for pain, there's no way, I am the authority, there's no sort of outside perspective to tell me I'm wrong about that.
You know, pain is in your head. There is just no question about it. That's where it's processed. That's where we experience it. It is a perception. And so it is in your head. But the problem here with that phrase is it's thought of pejoratively. It's a way to put down people and to discount that it's really an experience for the individual. It is an experience. And that what most people probably don't appreciate is that our response to a given stimulus can be very vast. So for the four of us in this room, the same stimulus can produce a large variation in the amount of actual experience of pain, both acutely and chronically. But it's real for that individual, as long as they're not lying, as you said, Sarah. But if you're not lying, intentionally lying, which rarely happens in my experience, it is real, regardless of what the individual says.
Yeah, pain being both relative and real is, you know, I recently discovered that redheads require more anesthesia. I mean, that is both objective and an example of the same pain being kind of relative.
Well, we know that there are genes that are pain reducers and genes that contribute to enhancing pain. And just to give the same kind of assessment or quantitative or qualitative marker for a given stimulus is just not scientific. It's not the neuroscience. And fortunately, understanding that will allow us to develop therapies that are genetically based.
Well, hang on, because we've got to take one last break. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today's Central Standard is all about pain. We'll get back to it in just a minute on KCUR. Good morning, everyone. I'm Gina Kaufman, and I know a lot of people equate Mondays with pain, but today on KCUR's Central Standard, we are formalizing that connection. Pain is the topic of today's show. We're exploring it with dancer Jane Gotch, medical pain expert Lynn Webster, and philosophy professor Sarah Robbins. Hi again, guys.
Hello.
If you have a unique insight into pain and how we deal with it based on your profession, there's still a little time to chime in. 816-235-2888. We were just talking about pain being both relative and real. And Sarah, tell us some more about some experiments you know about.
So philosophers like not only to think about our intuitions and our concepts, but to actually do a bit of experimenting ourselves and asking everyday people what their intuitions are about how pain works. And although I think it's part of the common idea that pain is all in our heads, if you ask people, and some philosophers have done this research, a philosopher, Justin Sitzma, who's in New Zealand, has done some clever studies asking people, you know, whether the pain, if you've stubbed your toe, you're walking, when you get up in the morning, you hit it on the dresser, whether that pain is in your toe or in your head, and people will say that it's in their foot, of course. And you can test this more thoroughly by asking them a case where you compare, you tell them a story of two people who are conjoined twins who are joined at the torso and through the parts of the leg and receive some injury to the leg, you say, are they experiencing the same pain or a different pain? And they'll say they're experiencing one and the same pain. Whereas if you contrast that with a case, you say the same two people are, they're not conjoined, but they're in a three-legged race together and they've had their legs tied together and they have the same injury to the same spot. They'll say, oh, there are now two pains here. So it looks like one of the things philosophers learn from asking people these kinds of cases is that our intuitions are that the number of pains corresponds to the number of body parts, not to the number of brains. So, of course, people can be wrong about that, but it's interesting that this is where our everyday idea about pain might go.
Lynn Webster, you were talking just before the break about that a lot of what we're learning about pain right now could lead to better treatments for pain. Can you explain some of maybe what's new and on the horizon in terms of the scientific community's thoughts about pain?
The general approach is, as I made the analogy earlier with cancer, is more personalized, meaning that we have to identify first what type of pain, where it's located, what receptors are being interfered with or stimulated, and then targeting those specific sites for new therapies. And that requires that we understand genetics. And so we have to understand the variability amongst all humans, at least the larger population, of our response to different therapies, but also our response to the painful stimulus. So, you know, about 60% of us have a very similar response, but there are 40%, 20% on both sides, basically, of that bell-shaped curve, who are going to have a dramatically different response to the same stimulus. And that's largely based upon our genotype.
Let's talk with Beth in Olathe. Hi, Beth.
Hello, Gina.
What can you share?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, yes. This is Beth Bird. Hi, Gina. Hi, Jane. I teach arthritis classes and silver sneakers classes, and what I deal with is the memory of pain and pain avoidance through movement. I notice a lot of pain avoidance movements that are no longer necessary for that person. Hello?
Hi, yes, go on.
Hello? Okay, sorry, it sounded like in the language. So I notice, and it depends on how long it's been going on for that person. One of the most common moves is if they've had a knee replacement, that kind of, or a hip replacement, they're afraid to step backward, even though the pain is no longer there. So a lot of times, one of the most triumphant moments in a class will be when somebody actually successfully takes a step backward and then put their feet back together and switch legs and step backward and put their feet together, that it no longer hurts. They've just been avoiding it for who knows how long. But in the meantime, their muscles have atrophied. So,
yeah,
I don't know. If they could discover that sooner, it'd be great, but it's never too late to discover it.
Thank you so much, Beth. I'd be interested, Jane, in your response, because you think so much about movement and just the idea that people train themselves to move according to their pain and keep moving that way even when the pain is gone.
I find with my students and myself that it's so much about being in the practice of being in the present moment, because if we are still in the past of what we felt, we will continue to move in a way determined by those thoughts and memories. One of the easiest ways to come into the present moment is to be aware of the breath. And by working with the diaphragm and the breathing, it oftentimes will also place the body into a better alignment. It will slow down our thoughts. It will open space to form a new way of doing anything, if it's movement, for example.
Talk to me a little bit more about this phenomenon.
Well, I think Jane's absolutely right, and the caller was correct about the memory issue. And unfortunately, this is what that's one of the protective mechanisms, as everyone knows. As a child, you learn soon when you touch a hot plate not to go back to that hot plate. And later, as we develop with our arthritic problems, we learn what hurts. And so that now you take away the hurt, you still have that memory. And that's part of the learning of the brain. So we have to undergo a neuroplastic change, meaning that the brain has to relearn then that you can go through different mechanisms. There's a diagnosis called congenital insensitivity to pain that is very rare, but it is the absence of feeling any pain. And if you're born with that, you are not likely to live beyond the age of 20 because you will fall, break your bones, you touch the hot stove, you develop an infection, and you don't even know it. So the learning process is protective early on. And then if we find a way to relieve ourselves, as Jane, you're doing with many of your clients, then it's you're really practicing the neuroplastic application of training the brain a different way.
Definitely. My students call it making real estate in the brain, or owning real estate in their brain.
I like that phrase. This is interesting, though, the idea of pain kind of as a teacher that we don't even kind of think about that way. But what about the idea of memory and pain? Like, if you don't remember pain, does it matter?
Yeah, I think this is probably something Dr. Webster can say more about, but and as a motivation for this. So I think that's really important. Sometimes this justifies whether certain things are okay to do, whether you would remember it later. And it's not entirely widely known, but up until the early 80s, most children under the age of 18 months weren't given any form of anesthesia when they would go into surgery, in part because, of course, there are dangers to putting them under anesthesia as well. But part of the motivation for that was the thought that maybe they weren't fully experiencing pain, but also that they weren't forming memories. And so even if they were, they wouldn't be remembering that pain. So there's a way in which that seems to justify a certain set of actions. So that makes that a more acceptable practice, because if pain isn't remembered, then there's a sense in which, you know, it doesn't have any forward-going reality for you.
That is so weird, because I think of pain as such a present moment kind of experience.
It is, but when it becomes problematic, I think, is when it attaches itself to suffering as a kind of a sense of a pain that has endured and it might never stop. And I think that's when it becomes especially personally and problematic.
You know, the children, the babies, they were experiencing pain, mm-hmm. and clearly the difference here is that cognitive awareness. When the nervous system was stimulated or is stimulated, that's occurring in the brain whether you're cognitively aware or not. We know that as anesthesiologists, for example, in the operating room. That's one of my basic training as an anesthesiologist. So even though we place an individual unconscious, the surgical stimulation is still being registered in the brain. And so they're still experiencing pain, but they're just not aware of it at that time. And so we have to be aware that any of that stimulus, any stimulus that gets to the brain, is creating a memory.
So the memory of it being significant in terms of suffering and also in terms of learning, but in the case of something like chronic pain, you know, that's an area of focus for you. Can you talk to me about, you know, the subtitle of your new book is What Chronic Pain Is Really Like and Why It Matters to Each of Us. Is there a difference between the perception of chronic pain and the reality of chronic pain?
Well, I think for some individuals that might be true, but probably not. And the reason I have that as a subtitle is because nearly every human being, at least in America, is going to touch pain. Either they're going to be a caregiver to somebody, or they're going to personally experience chronic pain. One out of two Americans at the age of 65 or older have chronic pain. One out of three Americans have chronic pain. So this is a very intimate topic for every American.
This is going to sound like a weird question, but what do you see as the future of pain?
Well, that depends upon society. What I'm hoping is that there becomes a cultural transformation. We need to have more recognition that pain is a disease and that it is destructive. It causes huge costs to society, both personally and financially, economically. And so we're a part of a social movement today to try to bring awareness and a change in attitudes towards the individuals who have pain so that we can bring more dignity and provide individuals access to treatment that haven't been there before. Hopefully we will get our lawmakers to understand that this is a huge issue, number one public health problem in the country, and that we need more investment, by NIH and Congress into developing new therapies so that we're not as reliant on the opioids that have caused such havoc in society.
Well, so, yeah, and that's very particularly speaking about chronic pain, right?
That's correct.
So, yeah, because I think maybe some philosophers would have something to say about pain as a disease otherwise.
Sure, as a disease of, yes, that it's a disease that lasts through, I'm not sure I can.
Part of the human condition.
Just a fundamental part of the human condition.
Yeah. Our time is up for this conversation. Keep talking about the different ways of understanding pain in our Twitter feed. If you like, we're at KCURCST. Sarah Robbins, thanks for joining us from KU's Philosophy Department.
Thank you.
And choreographer Jane Gotch, thanks for inspiring today's conversation with your recent dance, Let It Fall.
Thank you, Gina.
Dr. Lynn Webster, it's been cool hearing the latest on pain in the scientific community. Thank you.
Thank you.
His talk this evening is from 6:30 to 8 at the Community Christian Church. It's called The Painful Truth, a public forum, what chronic pain is really like and why it matters to each of us. Tomorrow, we'll be back with the history of the National Catholic Reporter based here in Kansas City. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's a wrap. Stay tuned for Up to Date next on KCUR. He'll lead me out if I live long enough to.